This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories in the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. Straight ahead on the program, the housing market and the economy. I'm Amy Morris in Washington.
I'm Stephen Carroll in London. We're asking if things look any better or worse for next year.
I'm Brian Curtis, Bloomberg Daybreak Asia. We crack the code on the biggest market trends expected in 2023 for Hong Kong and China.
I'm Joe Matthew in Washington. President Biden ends a tough year on a high note.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend on Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 991 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, DAB Digital Radio London, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good day to you. I'm Amy Morris. We begin today's program with housing. A bunch of housing data coming next week, including pending home sales for November. Economists we've surveyed are forecasting another drop. You remember pending sales fell in October as buyers faced mortgage rates pretty much at 20-year highs. Pending home sales are a leading indicator. So we're watching that one closely for you here this coming Wednesday with live coverage breaking it all down for you on Bloomberg Radio. Existing home sales also fell in November, but it's interesting. Some are saying home sales may not fall much more from here, including Mark Zandi of Moody's Analytics.
Yeah, I think in terms of home sales, I think we're pretty close to the bottom. And that reflects the peak in mortgage rates, which were back a couple months ago when they were significantly north of 7% for a 30-year fix. Now we're down closer to 6%. And I don't think we're going back to over 7 again. So I think we're pretty close to the bottom in sales.
Now, Mark Zandi of Moody's Analytics also tells us that home prices could fall more from here because mortgages are still just taking up too much of people's paychecks right now.
You're right. I mean, affordability has been completely hammered here, and that's the fundamental issue. You know, you mix the high mortgage rates with the previously high house prices. It's just too much to bear. I mean, I think the average monthly payment for a typical for American buying a typical priced home is up $700-800 from where it was about a year ago, and that's just not affordable. So we need a combination to restore affordability and get demand moving in the right direction again. We need a combination of lower mortgage rates, lower house prices, and rising incomes. And my sense is if mortgage rates come in back to 5.5%, which is where I would expect them in the long run, incomes continue to rise, we don't go into recession, we need about a 10% decline in house prices to restore affordability sufficiently. That probably won't happen until late 24 going into 25. So I think we've got a couple of years here before affordability will get to a place where, you know, demand will start to improve again, significantly improve.
Now, Mark Zandi, chief economist of Moody's Analytics, also tells us he thinks the Fed does not need to go too much higher on its benchmark interest rate. And one reason he thinks inflation is abating is that rents are coming down.
Market rents, you know, the rents that are being charged people that are signing leases today, they've suddenly gone weak and down for in part because rents are so high that people can't afford to rent. So you have so-called demand destruction and a lot more supply. The supply chains are easing and builders can get appliances and building materials. Labor markets are easing. Foreign immigrants that work in construction sites are getting on the job. So getting a lot more properties going across the finish line to completion. More supply, less demand. Rents are weak, and that's going to show up in the cost of housing services over the course of the next six to 12 months. And that's one reason I feel reasonably confident that inflation is going to be coming in here pretty quickly.
We're also going to be getting the S&P CoreLogic Home Price Index this coming Tuesday. That is expected to show home prices fell about 1.5% monthly in October, but still gained more than 8% year on year. Michael Fratantoni is chief economist at the Mortgage Bank Association and says if mortgage rates stay lower than the October peak, we could see a big wave of home buying starting this coming March and April.
If we can keep rates 6, maybe a little bit below 6 as we get into the first quarter of next year, when we're at the beginning of the spring buying season, that's really going to be impactful. A lot of the folks that stepped away from the market in 2022 in May and June because of that sticker shock and stayed away through the fall, they still need to live somewhere. They're still seeing their rent increase. So I'm not going to be surprised if the market shifts a bit more towards sort of the first-time home buyer segment because, again, a lot of the folks that would have planned to have bought last year put it off given the spike in rates. If we get just a little bit of relief in mortgage rates, they could come back.
Michael Fratantoni is chief economist at the Mortgage Bankers Association, and he also tells us he thinks that nationally home prices won't fall too much more next year, maybe 1 to 2% down on the year. We'll be getting more data on that from the FHFA this coming Tuesday as well. Housing demand very affected by the ability to get a mortgage. Another thing we're watching in the housing market, how big banks are doing on their promise to boost lending to Black homebuyers. Joining me now to talk about this very important part of the housing story that's shaping the economic health of housing and Black Americans in the months and years to come, Bloomberg senior economics writer Sean Donnan. Sean, it is always a pleasure. Thanks for taking the time with us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Now, set the stage for me here. You did a deep dive into a block in Baltimore, and this actually wound up being a feature story in a Bloomberg Big Take on the Bloomberg Terminal. It's really fascinating. Tell us what you found.
Yeah, what we dived into was really one of the main causes of the racial wealth gap in America. We have learned a lot about in recent years about how there's this persistent gap in wealth between Black families and white families and how that kind of gnaws at the economy. One of the main causes of that is the home ownership gap. Black families, about 45% of them, own the homes that they live in versus about 75% of white families. And that is a gap that has persisted for years. And one of the things we saw in recent years is the big banks in America, alongside other companies, make some big promises to the Black community, to the U.S. economy, to try and close that racial wealth gap, that home ownership gap. And so we dove into that, and that took us all the way down to the 2900 block of Walbrook Avenue.
Now, when you got there, when you were digging deep, let's say, did you find that promises were made and, well, not kept necessarily, but at least the attempt was there?
So the promises that we looked at were some big, ambitious promises made by the banks. Wells Fargo in 2017 made the biggest of those. It said that it would lend $60 billion, $60 billion to create 250,000 Black homeowners in America within a decade. And so we looked at the data, and what we found was that actually every year since making that promise, Wells Fargo, which was the biggest bank player, it was actually the biggest player in the mortgage market back in 2017, that every year since making that promise, Wells Fargo has actually backed fewer mortgages to Black home buyers than it did the year before. And that it's gone down to a point where actually the San Francisco-based lender underwrote 42% fewer mortgages to Black buyers in 2021 than it did in 2017 when it made that promise. It isn't the only bank to have made such a promise. J.P. Morgan in October 2020, after that summer of racial reckoning that we had in America, made a promise to create or originate mortgages to an additional 40,000 Black and Latino buyers over 5 years. Now, it's much earlier into delivering on its promise, but in 2021, it originated just 122 more mortgages to Black home buyers than it did in 2019, the year it set as a benchmark. And its lending to Latino home buyers actually went down in 2021. Bank of America has made some slightly different promises. They're broader, they're harder to measure, but it's pledged $30 billion in lending and down payment assistance to minority and low-income homeowners in America. All of this matters because what we're seeing across the board, and what we've seen over the last 15 years, has been a big dip in originations and mortgages that are issued to Black home buyers in America. And that hasn't caught up with where we were back, if you you remember the last financial crisis, the 2008, 2009, the subprime crisis, with the type of lending we had back in the early 2000s, that didn't caught up to those levels until in 2020, actually, in the middle of the pandemic. And in that time, we've had a huge housing boom, a property boom in America, and there's a lot of wealth that's been created for homeowners in America that Black families simply have missed out on because they have that lower home ownership rate.
All right. Just terrific reporting, Sean. Thank you so much for digging deep into this issue. You can find it on Bloomberg's Big Take and on the Bloomberg Terminal. Thank you so much, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
Bloomberg senior economics writer Sean Donnan. And coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, things aren't exactly looking up for the UK economy in 2023. More on that just ahead. I'm Amy Morris. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Amy Morris in Washington. Up later in our program, has President Biden really finally hit his stride? But first, a roller coaster year for the UK economy, with political upheaval adding to the already gloomy economic outlook. Things aren't looking up in 2023 either. The OECD is warning the UK is set to be the worst performer in the G20, except for Russia, for the next 2 years. For more, let's go to London and bring in Bloomberg Daybreak Europe anchor Stephen Carroll.
We've had three prime ministers, four finance ministers, and one ill-fated budget in the UK this year. All of that dragging the pound within an inch of parity versus the US dollar at one point. Overall, it's been quite the wild ride for the UK economy. Now the Bank of England is expecting a prolonged recession in 2023. Joining us to discuss the year that was and what's ahead are our UK correspondent Lizzie Burden and our senior UK economist Dan Hansen. Lizzie, let's start with you. One measure of the volatility we've seen this year is in the pound. Talk us through what were the highlights and lowlights for sterling in 2022.
I think it's very obvious what the low light would have been, but you could say that this whole year has been an annus horribilis for sterling. So we started the year at $1.35, and then the pound dropped to a record low in September of near dollar parity. And of course, that was just after the mini budget. And ultimately, it was the chaos in currency and FX markets that ousted Liz Truss. They were the guardrails on the government in the end. Now we've got Rishi Sunak in number 10. His fiscal plans are obviously more austere than Liz Truss's. This dullness dividend has helped to recover the pound somewhat, but even after the recent rebound, it's still sterling down almost 10% since the start of the year. Yes, dollar strength has played in, but to give it some historical context, 2022 has been the pound's worst ever, apart from the Brexit vote, the financial crisis, and Black Wednesday in 92.
Another collection of greatest hits. Dan, how is the UK economy finishing the year compared to how it started?
Well, it started the year pretty strongly if you look at the data, because if you remember back then, it seems an awful long time ago now, we had the rebound from the Omicron wave. So you had a pretty strong GDP reading at the start of the year. And since then, things have really, really slowed down. So the second quarter was, there was growth in the second quarter, but it was weak. And then we've obviously had a fall in GDP in the third quarter, and most forecasts are expecting a fall in GDP in the final quarter. Though I think, I know we're most likely going to have two consecutive quarters of negative growth, which, as we all know, that'll signal a start of a technical recession. But I think, try and sort of put a positive spin on it, actually those two quarters have been very, very mild in terms of their drop. So you've had a 0.2% drop in the third quarter, and the fourth quarter, the Bank of England has said that it thinks that the drop will be 0.1%. So yes, it's not good news. But when you put that in the context of the living squeeze that is occurring here in the UK, actually, the economy is holding up relatively well. Yes, we're probably heading into a recession, a protracted recession, but it's going, at least on our forecast, to be relatively mild. So I know those aren't words people want to hear, recession, downturn, but actually when you look at the depth of it relative to his past downturns, it doesn't look like it's going to be as bad.
Okay, Lizzie, in terms of sterling, are we over the worst of the upheaval that we've seen this year when we look into 2023?
Yes. But,
says she trepidatiously.
If you look at the options market, there's currently a 40% chance that the pound's going to get stuck between $1.10 and $1.30 for the next 2 years. And that's still its weakest ever trading range. And that's because of the factors Dan talks about. We've got a year of high inflation ahead, rising interest rates to combat it, a housing slowdown. And this is a continuation of a long-term downward trend. So the 5 years before the Brexit vote in 2016, the pound's average was about $1.59. The 5 years before that, it was about $1.76. But it's not just a Brexit thing. It's, well, Brexit has created more trade frictions with the EU. It's left the labour market short of workers. It's undermined business investment. Looking ahead, Bank of America, I was there speaking to the economists last week, they say that sterling in 2023 is actually going to be dominated by Brexit and whether this government can reach a compromise on Brexit, whether they can find a sustainable solution on the Northern Ireland Protocol. And I have to say, even though Rishi Sunak, probably for the benefit of the Brexit wing of his party, has talked tough on not wanting a Swiss-style deal, as was reported. Actually, in the markets, people are very optimistic that he will be pragmatic on Brexit. So for me, 2023 is about revealing how much he's willing to stand up to his party, or in their eyes, the degree to which he's a true Brexiter.
Yeah, indeed. And of course, the deadline for that that everyone's notionally aiming for is the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement in April of next year. So the hope is that they will have done a deal between the UK and the EU by then that will resolve the issues and allow there to be an official commemoration of that deal without the ongoing political tensions that we've seen in Northern Ireland on that issue.
And optimistically, all of this back and forth is just choreography to show that everybody's trying to defend their sides. But hopefully we'll get to something then.
Yeah. Let's take a listen now to what the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey said at their last rate decision about what he expects in terms of inflation next year.
We think we've seen possibly this week, you know, the first glimmer that with the figures that were released this week, that it's not only beginning to come down, but it was a little bit below where we thought it would be. And that's obviously very good news, but there's a long way to go. And there is and we expect that to happen, by the way. We expect inflation to start falling more rapidly, probably from the late spring onwards. But there is a risk that it won't happen in that way, particularly because the labour market and the labour supply in this country is so tight.
Okay, so that's what Andrew Bailey has to say about the outlook for next year. Dan Hansen, what are the particular pressure points you're watching out for going into next year? Andrew Bailey seems to think things are going to improve pretty soon on inflation.
Yeah, so I think you can think of the inflation path next year in sort of two elements to it. So over the winter and into the first quarter of next year, we don't think inflation is going to drop below 10%. I think our forecast in March, in fact, just has it dropping a little bit low, below 10% to 9.5%. So you've got pretty sticky inflation for the next sort of 4 or 5 months. But then what we think at least, and we hope you'll see, is these base effects coming through and the impact of the energy price rises that we've seen this year falling out of the annual comparison. And what the governor was alluding to there was the good news from the latest inflation print was that core goods inflation. So this is the bit of the inflation basket that's been really impacted by supply constraints. And we've seen it coming off very sharply in the US. We think that part of the inflation basket is going to ease quite sharply as well. So I think what you'll get is a pretty sharp fall in inflation. But the key thing to remember here is that I think the easy bit is getting from, say, 10 to 4 or 5. Mm-hmm. The hard bit is getting from 4 or 5 to 2. And what that reflects is what's going on, as the governor mentioned there as well, is what's going on in the labour market and what's going on with services inflation. And before you get to services inflation, what's going on in pay. So I think you'll see a pretty sharp drop this year, but they're the sort of easy yards. You've got the harder yards to come, and that'll only really be revealed in the latter half of 2023, the sort of what's the residual bit of inflation, and that's really what will focus the bank next year as well.
Lizzie, we are rattling towards the end of the year in the UK amidst this massive wave of strikes. Is that going to be a continuing theme when we think about the labour market next year?
Well, my colleague Philip Aldrich, our senior UK economics reporter, had a really interesting conversation with Charles Goodhart, who's a former Bank of England policymaker. And he said that it might not just be a winter of discontent, it could be a year of discontent, unless the government agrees to a wage deal to end this industrial action. Labour's point, the opposition Labour Party, is that you need to treat it as a whole rather than strike by strike, union by union. And if you think about what Dan's saying, that this inflation is going to be sticky, it's not going to drop below 10% for 4 to 5 months, that really keeps the pressure on the government.
Okay, thank you very much to Bloomberg's UK correspondent Lizzie Burden and to our senior UK economist Dan Hansen as well. I'm Stephen Carroll in London. You can catch us every weekday morning here for Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, beginning at 6 a.m. in London and 1 a.m. on Wall Street.
Thank you, Stephen. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, President Biden continues to chalk up successes, but can it last? We'll find out. I'm Amy Morris. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting live from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio in New York.
Bloomberg 1130.
To Washington, D.C.
Bloomberg 991.
To Boston.
Bloomberg 1061.
To San Francisco.
Bloomberg 960.
To the country.
Sirius XM Channel 119.
To London.
DAB Digital Radio.
And around the globe.
The Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com.
This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend.
I'm Amy Morris in Washington with your global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. Has President Biden really finally hit his stride? For more here in our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington, we go to Bloomberg Sound On host Joe Matthew. Joe.
Thank you, Amy. President Biden feeling good as he heads into the new year after what was arguably the best midterm performance by a sitting president in decades. The president saying it's clear Americans are committed to protecting and defending democracy.
The strong rejection of election deniers at every level, from those seeking to lead our states and those seeking to serve in Congress, and also those seeking to oversee the election.
Joining us now to talk about this, Bloomberg White House reporter Josh Wingrove. Josh, happy holidays. Great to see you. Thank you for being here as we talk about this moment for Joe Biden. Not only did he outperform in the midterms, your reporting shows that he did a bit of an end run around his own advisors by insisting that democracy itself be on the ballot, as opposed to so many other issues that were in the air. I guess his instincts were correct.
Yeah, I think, look, this is a guy that likes to measure twice or three times and four times, five times, and then cut once, right? Like, the knock on that strategy is sometimes they can appear a little flat-footed. But on the flip side, you know, he thinks that he keeps his eye on the ball, or, you know, has a focus that he's not distracted. You know, rewind to the start of the year, right? You know, the inflation was really taking off. The COVID cases, we all remember the Omicron surge a year ago was insane. Of course, Russia was about to invade Ukraine. Things were stalled in Congress. Everything had collapsed with Manchin. And, you know, things turned around. They got some bills through Congress. The midterm performance they're pretty happy about. And so on balance, you had Biden there being like, how can I frame this? How do we avoid the bloodbath, politically speaking, that presidents usually see in the middle of their first term? And, you know, he's been sitting down talking with historians, that sort of thing. So that's when you got this focus on, we got to make it on democracy. We got to be like, vote for anyone that will honor the result of the vote.
Yeah.
Do you remember he did that speech in Philly that kind of bombed? It was like weird background and like red and very like, you know, 70s horror film kind of like look. So he did a sort of, took a second kick at the can, a bit of a haphazard one here in D.C. But they think that that was part of the message that resonated, of course, in the broader context of other messages as well. You know, things like the moves on student loans, for instance, motivating young voters, things like that. You know, it's a cocktail of stuff. He's buoyant right now. You can tell because he's a little chippy with the press. You know, that he feels emboldened a little bit right now.
I liked Newt Gingrich's take in your piece, the former speaker, basically referring to Joe Biden's challenges that lead many Republicans to underestimate him. His speech impediment, his memory lapses that lead Newt Gingrich to compare Joe Biden to Eisenhower, even Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, well, Gingrich has kind of put himself out on a limb, right? If you read his blog post, essentially what it is, he's enumerating a pretty sharp, grueling attack on Joe Biden. But the headline is, we keep underestimating him. In other words, he's trying to convince his fellow sort of Republican brethren that, that, you know, just sort of casting Biden as, like, you know, either extreme, which voters tend not to believe because he's been around, he's kind of a known quantity, or as, you know, bumbling grandpa or great grandpa or whatever, then they sort of get away from the stuff that actually might work more and be like, we should attack him for his policies. So you have Gingrich saying, look, if we just write Joe Biden off because he's now 80 years old and we think he's going to stumble his way out of the presidency, out of 1600 Pennsylvania, then he thinks that they should give their head a shake. So that's the argument from Gingrich. You know, we reached out to a lot of Republicans for their thoughts on what Newt Gingrich is saying. We got a lot of no responses. Wow. So, you know, it's a pitch that they're willing to let sail right by rather than taking a swing at. So we'll see whether Gingrich is speaking for the sort of silent, you know, chunk of the party who might think that. But remember, we're sitting here, you know, Joe Biden has not formally announced his reelection campaign, but gosh, all signs point to yes.
Yes, I mean,
this is a guy that is not looking for his exit.
And he'll have inflation waiting for him when he makes that decision and when he enters the new year and the new Congress begins, as he tries to put a good face on all of this.
In a world where inflation is rising at double digits in many major economies around the world, inflation is coming down in America.
Then again, ask Mohammed Alarian.
Inflation is not going to come down in an orderly fashion. We're going to get sticky inflation.
The Bloomberg opinion columnist on Bloomberg, of course, sticky inflation. It's come down a bit. The Fed is still working. And you've also got the prospect of breaking the job market to fix the inflation issue, Josh. How do you square that when you're starting a reelection campaign?
You know, look, yeah, the chance is that even if it doesn't come down, you know, Joe Biden could be facing a recession either a year or even 6 months out of the next election. That sucks for any president to go into a re-election campaign.
It's a technical term.
Right, yeah, that's the macro term. So, you know, he right now, I think that they are praying that some of this stuff kicks in. And in the meantime, some of the stuff that they have done, which is a little bit nibbling around the edges, if we're being honest, but not for the people who it affects, it starts to kick in. Things like Medicare capping the cost of insulin for certain people starting in January, that's a big deal. Biden's approach to inflation has essentially been, we can try to lower certain costs per month for certain people to try to ease the pain across the board and costs that everyone in America is facing.
The thing is, if he did get a recession, energy prices would fall, food prices would fall. He enters the final year of a presidential campaign. Inflation is licked. We're going to fix the economy. And the guy I'm running against could be under indictment by then.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I don't know that any president wants to see a bunch of people losing their jobs.
Of course.
Right, and then, like, equity matters to this administration. I mean, some people think it might be virtue signaling here and there. But, like, the people that will lose their jobs are the types of people, workers, that Joe Biden, at least rhetorically, talks about a lot, right? They're people that live paycheck to paycheck, hourly wage workers, often minorities.
Just like he grew up.
Right, exactly. So, like, he genuinely seems to just believe that he thinks that there has to be a third way. There has to be a magical sort of landing here where, and, you know, he might be right, I suppose. I don't know. But that whereby inflation can come down. And all those folks who so often are the first ones to take it on the chin are the ones that don't have to do it yet again. I think that is what he's sort of holding his breath on.
Spending time with Josh Wingrove here as we slide into the new year. And I have to ask you about Ukraine. What a performance this week and a historic appearance from President Zelensky speaking to a joint session of Congress. Of course, he spent most of his day with President Biden at the White House. And there was one resounding message.
Your money is not charity. It's an investment in the global security and democracy that we handle in the most responsible way.
So, in our remaining moment here, Josh, how much of a challenge is it going to be for Joe Biden to continue the money and the weapons flowing to Ukraine in this new Congress?
We don't know. There's one challenge that he can control or has more control over, and there's another he can't. First, just to back up very quickly, you know, this is a surprise visit. Biden seems pretty jazzed that he was that Zelensky was here. He seems to have gotten along well with him. The takeaway is twofold. Number one, big standing ovations for Zelensky.
Yeah.
Notable exceptions among top Republicans, or at least prominent Republicans. The question is, the $45 billion or so that the Omni carved out for Ukraine, is that the last bucket of money for Ukraine? Will Kevin McCarthy or whomever led Republican House allow another dollar to go out the door? Very unclear. The second thing, which got to what Zelensky publicly asked for in Congress next to Biden, wherever he could, you know, shouting from the rooftops, was more weaponry, more advanced weaponry, particularly offensive weaponry. And Biden has been hesitant to do that.
That's right? A different story.
He doesn't want to trigger something. So that's a real rub. Will Biden start ratcheting up the type of gear he's willing to send Zelensky? He's already been ratcheting it up, including the Patriot missiles he announced. And will Congress...
Jets and tanks might be a different conversation.
Different conversation. He certainly does not seem keen on it. He's hinted that he thinks NATO's support for the war would fall apart if he did it. So Biden has his own reservations about what to send. Congress has their own reservations about what check to write. Those two things, you know, are hanging in the background. But the top line was Joe Biden standing there and pledging Ukraine that the U.S. will be there for them as long as they're in this war.
Historic moment. Yep. Josh Wingrove is the man that Joe Biden looked at and said, if I had his voice, I would have been elected president a lot earlier.
It's great
to see
you. What am I doing with my life here, Joe?
You're talking on the radio. Everyone's listening to your voice.
That's right.
Happy holidays. Happy New Year. See you in 23.
Thank you.
Bloomberg White House reporter Josh Wingrove. Amy?
All right. Thank you, Joe. That was Joe Matthew, host of Bloomberg Sound On from our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom here in Washington. And you can hear Sound On with Joe Matthew weekdays at 5 p.m. Wall Street time. And for more political news coverage, you can tune into Balance of Power with David Westin weekdays at noon Wall Street time. All of that right here on Bloomberg Radio. Coming up next on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, a look at market trends to watch out for in China. I'm Amy Morris, and this is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Amy Morris in Washington. COVID is still very much hanging over China. Bloomberg Daybreak Asia host Brian Curtis keeping track of all of it for us. Brian.
Amy, China is reopening and Hong Kong is trying to wrest back the mantle of Asia's world city. As a result, we're curious what new trends we might see in markets in 2023 for Hong Kong and China. And joining us now is Sophia Orte Acosta, Bloomberg's chief China markets correspondent. Sophia, after a couple of very tough years for these two markets, might we see better market conditions in 2023?
I think the living with COVID story is the biggest theme going into next year. You know, there's still a lot of questions over whether this is reckless or not. Some people are calling it the big U-turn, but it's been so dramatic for China. It's perhaps the big V-turn on COVID zero. So the key thing here is data. You know, will China's reopening be positive or negative on the economy? Will it be good or bad for consumption? Is there going to be short-term pain for longer-term gain in terms of growth? And also for the rest of the world, you know, is it inflationary or will it actually lead to deflation? So it will be harder actually to track the effect of the outbreak on China's economy, because actually China releases, after releasing December data, it only then releases combined January and February data in March. So it will be a while before we get any kind of real sense of on the ground impact from this.
Do we have a sense that markets will get well out in front of the economy, or because the reopening has been so uneven so far, will investors really wait until they see the proof in the pudding?
Investors have kind of priced in the first leg of the reopening story. Some sell-side analysts saying that about 40 to 50% has been priced in. I mean, also, Brian, let's not forget the huge outflows that Chinese assets had in 2022. It really didn't take much to move the needle when it came to markets. You know, you only had to revert to the mean is already a 40% gain for Chinese stocks.
I'm curious whether investors think the party has done a flip-flop on market-friendly and business-friendly policies going forward and changing from what used to be pretty restrictive policy over the past 18 to 24 months.
It's been perhaps the biggest surprise ending this year is the policy environment's turning really more friendly for China investing. we tend to think that China cares more about the economy than it does about markets. And now it's all about creating a better environment and market confidence really taking center stage. This is highly unusual. The last time we heard any kind of wording around this was in 2018 when the trade war was really hammering confidence in Chinese markets. So what that means, we still don't know. A lot of support for private enterprise seems to be the focus. Also, refinancing help for private developers. You know, we're seeing a revival in financing efforts for property companies. That is extremely different and a complete 180 to the trends we've seen in the past 2 years.
Is there one big mega trend we can identify for next year?
One big mega trend, I mean, beyond the reopening story, is, I think, decoupling, whether that's still a thing. Every single geopolitical analyst was talking about that, and friendshoring, whether people are moving out of China, and whether, you know, China really showing itself as a more friendly actor in the global stage. We seem to be getting some evidence of that now. So is China aligning itself less with other actors like Russia and moving closer to the West? That would be a hugely positive development when it comes to investing in China.
Sophia, thanks so much. Always enjoy your insight. Sophia Orte-Acosta, Bloomberg's chief China markets correspondent. I'm Brian Curtis, along with Doug Krisner. You can catch us every weekday here for Bloomberg Daybreak Asia, beginning at 7 a.m. in Hong Kong and 6 p.m. on Wall Street. Amy?
All right, thank you, Brian. And that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend. Join us again Monday morning at 5 a.m. Wall Street time for the latest on markets overseas and the news you need to start your day. I'm Amy Morris. This is Bloomberg.